This story is called Vintage. Consider this man. This man takes care of thoroughbred horses. His life has been dominated far more by snorting horses than human beings for almost 30 years. Once homeless and broke and dog drunk, he scooped handfuls of horse oats from feed bags so he wouldn't die. "You just chew them up and spit out the husks," he says without emotion. This man's father used to bring home huge, bulging bags of dog chow draped over one shoulder to feed his coon dogs while his two sons ate coarse bologna on stale bread. This man dropped out of high school to join the army, breaking his mother's heart and abandoning a promising baseball career. "I'm not buying you another school book or lunch," his father said to him when he turned 18, just weeks before graduation. This man told no one of his reasons until the heavy drinking he discovered while in service to his country had long since had its way with him, wrecking his marriage, his self-respect, his health, his life. This man, in his 63rd year, lives in a succession of rooms never any bigger than 10 feet by 10 feet. Tack rooms with small windows high up on their walls and stained with the sweet pungency of oats and hay and liniment. Dormitory rooms with dusty concrete floors and dented and chipped scarred steel doors, almost always painted dark green. This man has not shit or pissed or showered or brushed his teeth in his own bathroom since 1978. For him, bathrooms are cinder-blocked, damp, dirty white places with water always running or dripping in the background, soiled with the stale smell of other people's excrement, designed with the least common denominator of bathroom business in mind. This man has no teeth. He had them all pulled in 2003. He said they gave him headaches. "I didn't know your teeth could ruin you," he says solemnly, squinting and rubbing his jaw to communicate pain. When he sleeps now, his mouth caves in on itself and he looks dead. When he chews, his jaws accordion cartoonishly. He seems not to notice. In January of 1980, this man sat in the rec room of the Veterans Administration Hospital in Lexington and tried to make sense out of a paint-by-number picture of a clown. Three numbers, three colors. He stared at the page while a doctor looked on and took notes. He was hours sober, hours after almost 20 years of black alcoholism, the kind that never, ever permits escape, and he had no notion of the time of day, the president's name, or when he had last been dry. After struggling to match number to color to shape for nearly an hour, his head ached and his vision blurred. He turned to the doctor. "Can I build the birdhouse instead?" This man, maybe 5 weeks from dead, stumbled into the hobo jungle under the West Main Street Viaduct one night looking for wine. The idea of pouring antifreeze through bread and drinking the remaining green nectar kept gnawing at his brain like a ragged and cruel tongue twister, and he kept shoving it away. He knew that was the end. Had known men who rode the booze train to that station and disembarked forever. But he also knew he would do even that if he had to, because dying was better than drying. He stumbled upon a couple, a young man and woman, warming their hands at a barrel fire in the hobo jungle. They smiled up at him, orange smiles and warm flame light. "Y'all got any wine?" he asked. "We don't drink," the young man said pleasantly. "Oh, y'all got any cigarettes?" "We don't smoke," the young man said. "Well, what are y'all doing down here in the hobo jungle?" "We just like it down here," the young woman said. "This is where we're comfortable," the young man said. This made the man's head hurt, and it made him laugh. He stumbled off and found some wine, permitting him at least one more night to scoff at the folly of drinking antifreeze. 2 days after failing to paint a clown or assemble a birdhouse, this man sits in the VA rec room again, trying to place white letters on black sandwich board felt. He has been given the privilege of preparing the welcoming sign for Anita Madden's visit to the facility, and someone has written out the message for him and placed it on a chair beside him. "Welcome to the Veterans Administration Hospital, Leestown Branch, Lexington, Kentucky." But the letters swim and melt and change places as he looks at them. He moves his eyes back and forth from words on page to plastic white letters to black felt surface. He rubs his head. He looks up at the doctor taking notes. This man doesn't hate black people, but he doesn't trust them either. "Put the clothes you got on in this paper bag," the fat black hospital orderly tells him. "You can either throw them in that trash can over there or send them home. Then put on this gown." It is white with tiny blue flowers all over it, and it clearly won't quite close in the back. The man is still drunk, but he is coming down, and he hates the big black man, in his addled state, identifying the nearest person as the source of his misery. "Do I have to put that gown on?" he asks. "No," says the orderly. "You ain't got to do nothing." "Can I smoke?" "Yeah," the orderly says. "You can do whatever you want. But if you do change out of them clothes, here's a bar of soap for lice, and here's one for cleaning. Showers are down the hall." So the man smokes one cigarette after another, becoming more and more angry, snatching and ripping through the pages of a magazine and shooting the fat orderly death looks. At some point, he sees a panel truck pull up outside with the picture of a hot dog slathered in mustard painted on the side, and he suddenly can't remember the last time he ate. Like an animal without thought, he is in the shower, scrubbing at his hair, his armpits, his ass, his genitals, his face. He is out and in the gown before he has time to dry, and he shoves as many hot dogs as he can get his hands on into his mouth until the grinning orderly makes him stop. It is the best meal he has had before or since. This man hates the electroshock they give him and the straitjackets they make him wear while he waits for a place to open at the VA hospital. But even in his saturated brain, he comprehends that the shock and the restraints are better, healthier than the streets. His cot, thin and wiry with a bar in his back, is preferable to his last bed, a concrete slab beneath an abandoned elementary school's defunct boiler near the hobo jungle, where he had stumbled in a drunken fog, sure that such a machine would be able to keep him warm until morning. So now he sleeps when he can and tries not to vomit on his own pillow when the DTs set in, and he wants to die. When he shakes and his teeth chatter, he wonders if the final shocking high of antifreeze would have been better. Almost 3 decades later, this man still does not know the name of the policeman who found him beneath the cold boiler that December night and decided to take him to the VA instead of the drunk tank. "He called my name into the police station, and they said, 'Yeah, he's a regular, bring him on down.' But when he found out I was a veteran, he took me to the hospital instead." This man does not choke up when he says it or make any big statements about how his life was saved, although clearly it was. The closest he gets to emotion is a slight head shake as he says, "I never did get his name or nothing, but that was one damn good policeman." This man would rather not have a black man help him, but the fat black orderly, Mr. Charlie Morton, doesn't seem to care what he would rather have. He makes sure the man has sheets and underwear and that he takes showers and goes to the chow hall for meals. It is from Mr. Charlie Morton that this man learns that the doctors had given him up for dead, that he has about two weeks to live, that every single one of his vital signs has sagged to the point from which virtually no one returns. "You're one step from dead," Mr. Charlie Morton says cheerfully. The final stop for alcoholics. This man does not like Mr. Charlie Morton referring to him as him so casually as an alcoholic, but Mr. Charlie Morton does not say it with cruelty. He just says it. And he smiles when he says that the one good thing about it is that the man's two young boys will be allowed unlimited visitation hours at the hospital the next Sunday. This man's boys don't know about the unlimited visitation hours or what they signify. They don't even know why their father is in the hospital. But they cry when they see Mr. Charlie Morton wheel Daddy off the elevator in a wheelchair, the required mode of transport from one area of the hospital to another. They are so afraid they do not even approach Daddy until he stands up and limps over to them. Seeing no obvious injuries, they throw their arms around him and play games with him from lunchtime till bedtime in the rec room while their mother sits and reads magazines and watches them from across the room. With 16 arrests and 13 convictions, almost non-existent blood pressure and pulse rate, a violent separation and divorce, a streak of abject homelessness, and countless failed attempts to stop drinking, this man has almost no chance of staying sober. Any betting man would lay safe money on attending his funeral within 6 months of a police officer dragging him from beneath a refrigerator box and shining a flashlight into his dead eyes. This man's own father mocks his latest attempt, inviting him in for a beer and snorting, "How long is it going to last this time?" Even those at the VA who had seen him complete the recovery program 2 years earlier, only to head straight to Wildcat Liquors as soon as he graduated, regard him with pitying but bleak eyes. Yet, this man made it. December 26, 1980, marks the last day he took even a sip of booze. Maudlin TV movies and mawkish feel-good films make this man's feat seem commonplace, but in reality, anyone as far gone as he was is already counted among the dead. yet he made it. Consider this man. This man, after drinking rot gut whiskey and cheap beer constantly for nearly a quarter of a century, made it. This man lived for years on the streets, begging, stealing, fighting, hating himself, despising others, but somehow he made it. A year after this man quit drinking, his father, also an alcoholic, gave up any hope of staying sober and blew his own head off with a shotgun. He left no note and pulled the trigger with a yardstick. And this man could not even attend the funeral for fear that grief would propel him back to the streets. Yet he somehow made it. This man's only constant companions for 30 years have been horses, their creaking stables and lumpy exercise tracks and harnesses and bulging glossy eyes constituting life as he knows it. Loneliness is as much a part of his world as clouds and blacktop. Yet he made it. This man has, by his choice, been essentially homeless since the late 70s, moving from one racetrack to another, living in small concrete cubes, bearing one electrical outlet, and marauding granddaddy longlegs and silverfish. Yet he made it. This man is a walking miracle. This man's survival defies reason. This man is my father, and he made it. It has almost become a ritual to me. At least once a year, I ask my father if he still wants a drink. Through much of my teen years and into adulthood, I asked out of fear. While I could no longer really imagine my father drunk and black-eyed and bloated and pale, it was what I dreamed about when I went to bed thinking about him. But now, almost 28 years later, I ask out of awe. I spend 11 months of every year turning the number over and over in my head, recalculating it, getting used to it, loving it, being dumbfounded by it. 10 years, 15 years, 20 years, and now almost 30. It seems too big for me, too much. I try to imagine myself giving up an obsession, even a small one, completely for 30 years, and it's like trying to articulate a word that doesn't exist. So I ask him at least once a year, sometimes more, and every time he doesn't seem to notice that I've asked before. He responds, as he does to most things, calmly, without emotion. As long as I stay out of bars and cocktail lounges, I'm okay, he will say. Or, as long as I stay busy, I'm all right. And at the 20-year mark, I asked just a few days after the anniversary, expecting an at least semi-profound answer upon such a momentous occasion. I am a sucker for landmarks. But he just said, the billboards used to get to me, the ones advertising beer and liquor, but finally they don't bother me no more either. Since then, I have not been able to ignore those signs. That billboard advertising, which I pass all the time without feeling like I'm noticing, can plague someone for 20 years, says a lot for the advertising industry, but not much for the human psyche. But the last time I asked him, he didn't answer the question directly. This is sometimes his way. Often it seems like he is answering a completely different question from the one you asked. Some of these people know him. Do you still think about drinking, Dad? We were sitting in torn vinyl chairs at the Turfway Park canteen drinking coffee. I had driven him up to Turfway one Sunday afternoon. Somehow he had found himself in Lexington while his car, a 1986 wrecked hatchback, he describes without a hint of irony or humor as vintage, sat parked outside the cinder block horseman's dormitory he currently calls home. He nodded and blew on his coffee. He took a sip, and I thought this was his answer. It was answer enough, I suppose, but I am nothing if not verbose, and I always want others to be too. But then he continued. I had a dream last night, he said. I dreamed I run off and joined the circus. I was down in New Orleans until Katrina. He spent nearly every winter working and living at the New Orleans fairgrounds, and they wanted me to walk an elephant through the French Quarter. I had started drinking again, and I was stumbling around drunk. I said, I don't know nothing about leading no elephant. I ain't never walked one of them before. And they said, you walked horses, ain't you? Well, it's the same thing. If you walked horses, you can walk an elephant. So I walked it down through the French Quarter, and that elephant tore the hell out of Bourbon Street. And everybody was running away from me or pointing and laughing. And that was it. He blew on his coffee again and took another sip. Then he looked up at me. I'm proud of you, son, he said, grinning. I wanted to ask why he should be proud of me instead of the other way around, But I wasn't sure I could speak, so I just nodded. I'm proud of you too, Dad, I thought. Let me show you this car I got, he said, and somehow gulped down the rest of his steaming coffee. It's vintage.